The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. The topic that it came up over the weekend for me. I had an email exchange with somebody about the topic of right effort. And so that's the topic that's on my mind this morning. So that's what we'll explore. I like to think of right effort as being kind of an orientation or a direction for how to engage in our practice, in our mindfulness practice, in our meditation practice. The term right mindfulness, comes because this factor is one of the Eightfold Path, and the term right is translated from the Pali Samma, and all the factors of the Eightfold Path begin with this term: right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And so the word right here it's not so much I'll just say it's the word right means this is a direction that will take us if we engage in the direction that these practices suggest, that it takes us in the direction of happiness, of freedom. If we choose to not engage in that direction, we're likely to end up struggling, suffering with reactive emotions. So the term right here isn't so much about a judgment. It's more about pragmatically, if you'd like to be happy, truly happy, these tools will help you. And so the orientation in the Noble Eightfold Path and the right aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path is an orientation towards freedom from stress, dissatisfaction, unease, suffering. So this is the whole orientation of the Buddha's search was how is it possible? Might it be possible to be free of suffering? You know, he looked around the world, and you know, we can look around the world today. It's not hard to find suffering in the world. Everywhere we look, there is suffering. There is also joy and happiness, and yet our relationship to the things that we often find joy and happiness about kind of hooks us back to this struggle. You know, when we have a situation that we like or that we feel like this is a good situation, you know, there's a way in which we feel like, I figured it out. I'm in control now. Just over the last few maybe the last year or two, I've really started to notice a kind of settling, relaxing that it feels fairly deep. It feels fairly, you know, it feels really good. You know, it's like, things are okay right now. And what I've seen often is that feeling is related to some idea that I'm in control. And so that kind of feeling, I figured it out, I'm in control, is based on an illusion that we're in control. So And often too, when something is happening that we like, you know, we're in a relationship that we like, or we're, you know, having a meal that we like, we tend to have a relationship to that that's like, ah, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is how life is supposed to be, with these pleasant experiences, with this relationship. I mean, it's like we're trained to believe that we should be able to have a life that's filled with entirely happy, pleasant moments. And so we feel like, ah, yes, this is right, this is good, when we're experiencing pleasant things. And it kind of sets us up, you know, in a way. Sometimes we do know at some level that this pleasant experience is impermanent. And we may have a sense of fear or holding or anxiety, you know, what if this goes away, or how can I keep this, and or a sense of doing to try to, you know, keep it going, a sense of activity, just, oh, you know, how much work does it take to keep a life going? I mean, just the simplicity of feeding ourselves and clothing ourselves and having a roof over our heads, how much work do we have to do that? So there is some kind of stress that is involved in this, creating a life that feels comfortable. And so and then there's not to speak of the times where things are uncomfortable, where things are unpleasant. You know, our relationship in those moments is often one of, how can I fix this? How can I get rid of this? Or that we blame ourselves. It's like, right, I've been taught somehow that I'm supposed to be able to control my experience. I'm supposed to be able to control or have the, you know, life unfold in a way that feels good. We know some of us have this orientation, and when we're not able to do that, we may feel like we're a failure, like we've completely failed at being a human being, or maybe we feel betrayed by the world. So there's that, you know, that relationship to just this kind of very natural unfolding of experience. Some experience is pleasant, some experience is unpleasant. And we have these different relationships to our experience. We like things that are pleasant. We don't like things that are unpleasant. We may also have a kind of a relationship that's in denial of this impermanent, changing nature of experience. And so in the Buddha's search, when he looked out and saw, wow, you know, there is suffering in this world, what he came to in his understanding was that things are going to happen in our lives. Now, the freedom that the Buddha found, the freedom from suffering that the Buddha found, is not a freedom from unpleasant things happening in our lives. But it's a freedom from the reactivity, the fear, the confusion, the anxiety, the holding, the contraction, the tension, the you name the reactive emotion that you're most familiar with. That reactive emotion has to do with our relationship to experience, with our relationship to this impermanent, unreliable nature of the world. And so this exploration around suffering, dukkha in the Pali, you know, and it's not just about like big suffering, it is also this dukkha that the Buddha explored and looked out into the world and saw everybody is meeting. We are not immune from this dukkha. It is from the subtlest level of stress or unease to full-on suffering. And all of that is coming from or connected to not necessarily what's happening in the world, but how we're relating to it. And this is actually really good news, because there's so many conditions out there in the world that we have zero control over. And if our happiness were to depend on somehow having a world that meets our requirements, somehow to have a world that fulfills what we want, it would be hopeless. Happiness would be impossible. And so, you know, the Buddha's quest, is it possible to find a true happiness, not dependent on the circumstances of the world? And he found, yes, when our relationship to the world comes into alignment with this truth, that things are impermanent, unreliable, out of control, there is a deep happiness that can be found. And so the exploration that he made is related to this relationship to our experience. So these three kind of habitual, there are three basic habitual relationships to what we experience. When things are pleasant, we tend to like them. We want more of them. When things are unpleasant, we tend to not like them. We want to get rid of them. And then there's this overall kind of filter or view of denial around the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, thinking that we should be able to fix or control. So these three basic relationships to experience: greed, aversion, delusion. They're very habitual. They're very ingrained, pretty much from the time we're born. And, you know, if you think about former lives, if you believe in former lives from many, many cycles of existence, we have been caught by these habitual patterns. And one of the succinct teachings of wisdom that the Buddha offered is, whatever we frequently ponder, that becomes the inclination of the mind. This is well understood in neuropsychology also, that when we use the mind in a certain way, frequently relate to experience in a certain way, you know, in a very impersonal way, you know, the way the nerves work is in a very impersonal way. When something is done, when some pattern is reinforced or practiced or engaged in over and over again, the nerve cells basically say, this one must be important. I'm going to shore this one up. And so when we frequently engage in aversion or greed or denial, the kind of the circuitry reinforces that. And so for a very long time, at least from the time that we came into this world, we have been practicing greed, aversion, and delusion. It's so ingrained, it's so habitual, it's often below our conscious level of what we're aware of. How many of you have had an experience where, you know, something happens and it's like, you know, we have this notion of buttons being pushed, right? You know, our families in particular. We do something or say something, and a brother or a sibling or a parent responds in a certain way that just like sends us through the roof. And it's not like we are even aware of why or what's going on underneath. It just happens like that. And so these are very well practiced, these patterns, these habits, and it can feel like that's just the way I am. When that happens, I get angry about it. When this happens, I get confused. When this happens, I get fearful. And so we think that you know, because we don't see the circuitry working underneath, it's kind of, you know, almost in the subconscious that these patterns are working. that we think there's no way to train, to change our habits, to change our patterns. And sometimes we try. I mean, I know before I met this practice, I definitely would try to change certain habits. And, you know, it would work for a little while, but I'd forget. And then I'd go back to those habits. So they're very deeply ingrained, very deeply conditioned. And yet, they are conditioned. They're not hardwired. Fortunately for us, they are not hardwired. And it is possible to decondition them. It's not easy, but it's possible. And this is what the teaching of right effort points to. How to decondition greed, aversion, and delusion. That's essentially what right effort is saying. That it's possible, and how to do it. So, I'm going to do a brief description of right effort. It's got four aspects to it. I'll say them and then talk a little bit about each one. So right effort includes both the direction of recognizing these conditioned patterns of greed, aversion, and delusion, and finding ways to let go of them and to guard against their arising, as well as pointing in the direction towards kind of the opposite qualities of mind, wholesome qualities of mind, such as mindfulness, concentration, investigation, tranquility of mind, equanimity, love, generosity, all a whole host of wholesome qualities of mind, that it's helpful to cultivate that side of the equation. And so the teaching on right effort says, you know, there's these qualities over here, these unskillful, unhelpful qualities based in greed, based in aversion, based in delusion. And the first two kinds of right effort say we should guard against the arising of these unhelpful qualities that when they have not yet arisen. So when they're not present, there's a way in which we need to be cognizant of what takes us in their direction and avoid going there. And then the second right effort is when these difficult qualities have arisen, the term is abandon them, let go of them. On the other side, with the wholesome qualities, the suggestion is to cultivate these wholesome qualities. You know, we can be aware that these wholesome qualities are not necessarily present. We may recognize that compassion or generosity are not easy for us, and we can cultivate them, actively engage in practices that support them. And the fourth right effort is to maintain wholesome states that have arisen. So the whole notion of right effort, first of all, depends on an understanding of what helpful mind states are and what unhelpful mind states are. The unhelpful mind states are those that are based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And this includes pretty much all reactive emotions. Confusion, boredom, sadness, anger, irritation, frustration, wanting, pride, avarice. These things that have a kind of skewed relationship with experience, these states of mind that have a skewed relationship with experience. They're based in what are called these three roots of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the first two kinds of right effort avoiding unwholesome states that have not arisen. You know, partly this is to just begin to be curious about what gets us. You know, this is about observing, so about being mindful, about recognizing what is it that gets us caught in these situations? What is it that takes us in the direction of being stuck in our habits? Some of this may be, a simple act of avoiding certain situations.
For instance, if you see that here's a silly example, but if you see that your mind gets really impatient when you're standing in really long grocery lines, one way to work with this would be to recognize, and this is one of the ways I work with this, I have a life that allows this, right? So I tend to do my shopping at times when fewer people are in the store. So I don't have to wait in long lines. So that's one way to avoid the arising of impatience. You know, you can see the situations that create it and avoid those situations. That can be skillful. It can be skillful. If, however, we can't always avoid situations. And this is crucial because this is where this avoidance piece becomes more about looking at our relationship. You know, that if, for example, you know, your life, you know, you work at, you know, the normal hours that most people seem to work, the 9-to-5 kind of job, and you have to do your shopping after work, and, you know, it's like everybody has to do their shopping after work, or everybody has to do their shopping on Saturday, so of course the lines are long. So it's like, okay, you don't have the option to avoid the situation. What does it mean to avoid the impatience in that scenario? How might it be possible to avoid that? There are different ways that this could happen. So, you know, you might recognize, first of all, that impatience tends to arise in that situation. Just simply knowing, you know, when I get into this situation, I tend to get angry, confused, upset, bored, irritated, frustrated, impatient, whatever it is. Just knowing that is helpful. Because if you're walking into that situation, you can remember, okay, yeah, I tend to get upset here, I tend to get impatient here. Let's see if I can just acknowledge that I'm out of control here, and this is a situation. Impatience is useless. So kind of orienting the mind in a different direction and seeing what happens. So mindfulness is a great ally for us in this avoiding aspect. This avoiding could also happen by consciously turning the mind in another direction. So, for instance, you might choose in the line to start doing metta practice. Start wishing people in the line well. I mean, you will see, and I see, at one point, for a whole period of, I think it was a long time, maybe about a year, I decided to use the Safeway as my metta monastery, my loving kindness practice monastery. I'd walk into the Safeway and I would start practicing metta, wishing well. This Pali term metta means loving kindness. Start practicing metta for everyone I saw. You know, there's a lot of suffering in the grocery store. People are impatient, they're tired, they're ready to get home, they're hungry, they're dealing with kids, they're dealing with the cell phone, it's like, wow, there's a lot of suffering there. And, you know, orienting my mind in that direction, oh, maybe I could practice well-wishing for the people I see in front of me in the line who are also frustrated and tired and impatient. Has a very different orientation. This
this act of turning the mind in a different direction, recognizing, okay, I tend to get impatient here. Let me choose to cultivate something helpful. Choose to cultivate metta. Can have the impact of helping us to avoid something unwholesome. And so this begins to show how these right efforts interplay. Because simultaneously to avoiding, in this situation where you go into the grocery store and you want, you know, or understand, yep, I tend to get impatient here. So simultaneously to recognizing that and recognizing, okay, how can I practice not going there? We choose to bring in an active cultivation of a wholesome quality of loving kindness. And so simultaneously we're cultivating the wholesome quality of loving kindness, which has the impact of avoiding the unwholesome quality of impatience. So these wise efforts, you know, it's not like you work on one and then the other. They very much interrelate. They very much interconnect. The second one of abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen. You know, that term abandon, can have a sense of like actively needing to get rid of. And I think because this is around these four are coupled with this word effort, we think that it means doing something actively to stop, to change, to fix, to get rid of. There can at times be an active quality to the letting go, the abandoning. It may be that we can, through just a simple recognition, you know, standing in that line, impatience arises. We may be able to recognize, oh yeah, there it is, and this isn't helpful right now. So, you know, that may help to let it go. But most of the time, I would say the vast majority of the time, our minds are not so easily amenable to just saying, oh, anger's arising? Let me not do that anymore. Confusion's arising? I think I'll stop being confused right now. You know, we can't just flip a switch and change our minds like that. And so this abandoning that's referred to here in the second right effort, in my own experience, it largely means that movement to allow a state to be there and yet be very mindful of it so that it doesn't move into action. This is what the Buddha meant by the middle way. When one of the things he meant by the middle way is that when we see something coming up, especially when we see an unwholesome state of mind coming up, not repressing it, not trying to stop it or shove it down, thinking that that's what abandoning means, not doing that, because that actually has an attitude of aversion to it, an attitude of not liking, an attitude of this is wrong, this is bad, shouldn't be feeling this. And so if we engage in that kind of repression, we are reinforcing a pattern of aversion, essentially. And so the middle way suggests that we neither repress, and yet nor do we like indulge in and say, oh yeah, anger, I'm going to really, you know, go with this anger. If we go with that anger and express it and get it out there and, you know, just that tends to be reinforcing the anger itself. or the impatience, you know, standing there, tapping your foot, letting the person in front of you know that you're impatient through subtle bodily cues so that they hurry up so that you can get there. I mean, just little things that we do, those kinds of things are reinforcing the impatience. And so the middle way is neither repressing nor expressing, but opening to allowing. This is like a whole different perspective. And this is what the perspective of right mindfulness is. What does it mean to be aware that impatience is arising and know that that is happening, feeling into that experience, and because we're able to feel into that experience, we're also able to recognize when it's moving or tending to be expressed by a gesture on the face or a tap of the foot or a cross of the arms or whatever we do when we're impatient. So that that mindfulness, a right mindfulness of these unwholesome states, is this middle way that allows it to begin to abandon itself. So right mindfulness has this wonderful quality that when we turn our attention to something that is unwholesome, unhelpful, it creates the conditions for it to release, and it creates the conditions for us to understand as we turn with mindfulness to something like impatience or any of the reactive emotions, we viscerally get the experience of how this is not a state of well-being. These reactive emotions are not in the terrain of what it's like to be in a mind and body that is experiencing well-being. Impatience takes us out of well-being. So the mindfulness gives us the recognition that these states of mind are not in the direction of a deeper happiness, a deeper peace, a deeper sense of ease, of well-being. And so that mindfulness gives us gives the mind the information it needs to recognize, you know, this state of mind is not helpful. It's not possible usually in that moment to just say, oh, this isn't helpful, let me stop it. But the mind is getting the education of, yeah, this state is not helpful, and I understand viscerally it's not well-being. That experience, of mindfulness of those states, not only helps the state to release, because our organism actually naturally, when it gets good information, our organism wants to move to well-being. And actually our whole mode of habitual reactivity is operating, thinking we are trying to find well-being. You know, we get little moments of well-being when we, you know, finally our impatience has had an effect and somebody has hurried out and there we are, we're checking out and, there I am. Okay, we get a little hit of, things are okay now. But because we've reinforced that habit, it's likely to come up again. You know, if the cashier's a little bit, slow or has to ask for a price, it'll just pop right up again. So the cultivation of wise mindfulness begins to help us get the information that allows our organism to follow its kind of gravitational pull towards well-being. It gets the information, this is not helpful. And it's the mind starts to let go of that. The mind starts to let go of these reactive emotions. And because the mind really clearly understands in that moment, this is not well-being, it also creates the conditions for the avoiding of that state in the future. Again, not something that we're actively doing, but that the mind begins to recognize, headed towards that state of impatience, I know where that's going. That's not something that the organism wants to go towards. So the right mindfulness is a form of abandoning. It's a slow form of abandoning. It takes a long time for that letting go to happen. But at the same time, we're not expressing or repressing. And so we're not cultivating, we're not encouraging that pattern, we're not reinforcing the pattern of impatience or anger or whatever reactive emotion. And so it's being weakened. That pattern is slowly, slowly, slowly being weakened. This abandoning can be so gradual. You know, we want immediate feedback. We tend to want our practice to prove to us right now this is working. And we get little hints of that. I'm going to try to fix this. So we get little hints of how it works when we're mindful and see, you know, oh, what it means to just be with impatience rather than acting on it or repressing it. We may get a little hint of, ah, a space around it or a release around it. So we may get a little hint of that. And, you know, our habitual minds, you know, basically think, oh, I've seen that one. Okay, good. Don't have to do that one again. But our habits are so deeply ingrained that over and over again we have to see these patterns with mindfulness. Over and over again we have to witness this. It's like just a slow wearing away, a gentle wearing away. But this is a form of abandoning. It is a form of abandoning. So this wise effort can mean just simply being mindful. And this kind of addresses a frequent question I hear around wise effort and wise mindfulness. You know, we hear the word wise effort, and I think because of that word effort, we tend to think it means a doing. You know, that we're supposed to fix things. We're supposed to get rid of the unwholesome. We're supposed to figure out how to construct the wholesome. So just that word effort gives us that idea that wise effort is about a doing. There is a kind of a doing there, but that doing can be in the direction of cultivating an allowing mindful attention. So that the quality of mindfulness, of just witnessing, oh yeah, here it is, this is impatience, that creates the conditions for the abandoning of that state. It creates the conditions for the future that the mind tends to avoid that state. And not only that, at the same time, we are cultivating the wholesome quality of mindfulness. And maintaining that wholesome quality as it has arisen. And so again, here's a way that as we cultivate a wholesome quality, such as mindfulness, I used loving kindness before as the example of a wholesome quality that we can cultivate that has this two-sided function of both strengthening the wholesome quality and letting us release or abandon, let go of the unwholesome. Likewise with mindfulness. In cultivating mindfulness, we are strengthening the wholesome quality of mindfulness, maintaining the wholesome quality of mindfulness, and letting go of the unwholesome. So these four right efforts can really be four sides of a single process. Whether we are choosing what to pay attention to, in the example with with the metta, you know, in the grocery store. Go into the grocery store knowing, yep, tend to get impatient here. So really finding, being aware, being, you know, recognizing, being really honest with yourself about where your mind tends to get caught in these reactive emotions, and then, you know, kind of being cognizant, conscious as you move into those situations, how might I engage in a different way in this situation? So in that case, using metta, you know, actively choosing, I'm not going to pay attention. This is one of the key tools around avoiding, to not put attention on the thing that creates the reactivity. So if you get angry at somebody, or, you know, you're impatient with the person in front of you in the grocery store line, we tend to, in acting on that impatience, to focus on that person or that situation. And focusing on that person or that situation tends to reinforce the impatience. So this is one of the skillful means around avoidance. Take your attention out of the situation that's creating or supporting the reactivity. And in one case, we might actually choose to direct the attention to a wholesome quality such as loving kindness. Just kind of change the channel. Change the channel. So that's a case where we use wise mindfulness to actively choose an experience to attend to. We bring loving kindness into our field of awareness. Actively, perhaps doing a practice. May you be happy. May you be safe. So this kind of mindfulness is directing the attention, choosing what to pay attention to, taking the attention out of the situation. Or we could engage with that situation with wise mindfulness, recognizing, impatience is arising right now. This is what's actually happening in this moment. This does have the effect of also having our attention be moved out of the situation that's creating the reactivity. It's like instead of attending to the person or the situation that's creating the reactivity, in a way we are not trying to create something new in the present moment, but we are turning towards what is arising in the present moment with wise mindfulness. Oh, impatience is arising right now. What is this experience? Frustration, boredom, confusion, irritation, anger, rage, greed, whatever it is, taking our attention out of the thing that we are reacting to and turning towards that experience itself. With wise mindfulness, this again, as I just described, allows the releasing of that difficult state and the cultivation of the wholesome quality of mindfulness. And so wise effort and wise mindfulness work together. They're not opposed to each other. Sometimes people hear the teaching on wise mindfulness as being, oh, just notice things as they are. And people hear the teaching on wise effort is, don't just notice things as they are, change them so that you get rid of the unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome. There's a much more complex relationship between wise effort and wise mindfulness than that. Wise effort creates this orientation or direction of, yes, understanding these unhelpful qualities rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion are not helpful to follow through on, to act out of. That it's helpful to let go of them, to avoid them, to cultivate wholesome qualities, to maintain wholesome qualities. And wise mindfulness can have this very receptive, settled back quality of, yes, just meeting this moment, noticing whatever is arising and being present for it. And wise mindfulness can also have a quality of recognizing, you know, when I try to turn my attention to this anger, I just end up caught in it all over again. And so maybe I need to change the channel. Maybe I do need to put my attention in some other experience, maybe loving kindness, or maybe just simply something else that's happening in the present moment, like my feet touching the ground, or my hands, or the experience of hearing. So the wise mindfulness can have this receptive quality, or it can have a directed quality. We use both of these two together to support this movement away from the release, the letting go of the unwholesome, and the cultivation, the movement towards the wholesome, which allows us to more and more experience more freedom, more ease, more peace in our lives. So, comments, questions? Yeah, and if you'd use the mic.
When you, this is just an image that popped up in my mind. When you said that if I am mindful of the anger, I am at the risk of getting caught up in it, and so I need to change the channel.
I would say that's something we need to be aware of in a given situation.
Okay.
That it may not, I mean, it may be, you may be able to be fully aware of the anger and not caught in it. And if that's the case, I would encourage just the basic mindfulness. But we have to be honest with ourselves. Oh, yeah, actually right now when I'm turning my attention to the anger, what it tends to do is I get looped back into it.
Well, the image that immediately came into my mind, just leapt into my mind spontaneously without thinking carefully about it, was maybe you could put on the mute button and watch the picture without the sound.
That's kind of what we try to do as we turn our attention away from the thing that's creating the reactivity towards the experience itself.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing is you were talking about how we have these conditioned responses that we want to get rid of. And the first thing I thought of is, two or three months ago when Governor Brown said that we have a drought, we need to reduce our water use, one thing I said right away was I'm going to reduce my baths as opposed to showers to twice a month instead of twice a week. And I said that one day, and the next morning, which was my usual bath day, I got up and without even thinking about it, I turned on the bath tap, and then there was about an inch or two in the bathtub, and I just said to myself, oh, wait a minute. Yesterday, I said I was going to stop doing this.
Yeah, I mean, that often happens too. You know, it's like we get into the pattern, and in the midst of it, mindfulness comes up.
Right.
And in that case, we just, we meet that. We need to meet it there.
Thank you for letting me go first, because I have to hightail it.
Okay. Yeah, we have another minute or two if there are other comments or questions. Yeah.
Well, I have a question. Question about things like humor, tools. I was feeling impatient in a grocery store, just as you described yesterday. Somebody sort of helped me find something. But I was still impatient. I said, somebody ought to hire you here then several other things happened as a consequence. So there's all kinds of tools.
There's many tools too. I mean, I just used a few examples. Humor is a great tool in our mindfulness practice. And sometimes what we see, too, that as we really start to see what's going on in our minds, it's amusing. We see, look at this, here it goes again. And we can have an attitude of humor around it. So the thing that I would encourage with that is, humor can be used. Humor is kind of what I'd say a neutral tool, right? It can have a skew that's got that, that edge of impatience in it, or it could be used, from a wise perspective of, helping us to orient towards the truth. So to just recognize when it's, how it's being used. And often I think the unfolding of what happens gives us a clue to that. You said several things happened as a result. I mean, were those skillful things? Were those in the direction of letting go? Yeah. So that gives you the clue. And at other times you might see, you know, that humor results in a little bit of a, you know, reactivity, or, you know, some, maybe there's, you know, that skew in it. So yeah, just keep noticing.
Could you mention other tools like that come to
mind? I think some of the main ones that I use in my practice are using like reflections, wisdom reflections in the mind. So consciously remembering, right, this is impermanent, this is unreliable. And I often have found that finding your own language for wisdom, you know, this is impermanent, this is unreliable, this is not self, those are the kind of classic phrases that relate to wisdom. It can help to just remind ourselves of this truth, of these truths, as a way to, right, okay, yep, this impatience is conditioned on this situation, it's arising now, and it will be gone. Within 5 minutes, it will be gone. You know, to just remind ourselves around those things. Other tools might include, you know, bringing an active cultivation of wholesome qualities. So depending on the situation, you could bring in an active orientation towards compassion or towards love or even towards joy. You know, you might be impatient with a mom and her kid in the line. You know, I heard a story about a woman who, you know, there was in a grocery store line. She was very impatient, and the person in front of her had a little baby, and the cashier was cooing with the baby, and you know, she even held her and, you know, jiggled her a little bit and, you know, gave her back. And so there was some impatience, but this person decided to orient instead towards the joy that was, or something like that. You know, I don't remember the story in full, but I can imagine it being orienting towards the joy of the cashier's face, the baby's face, the woman who was, you know, who brought the baby in, their face. And, you know, it just shifted her relationship. And she was very relaxed and more at ease. You know, she didn't have that demonstration of agitation and impatience. And when she got to the cashier actually thanked her for her patience. She said, you know, that's my baby, and I don't get much opportunity to spend time with her. And so my, you know, whoever it was, a sister or friend, brings her in for me to, you know, see a couple times during the day. You know, when you really understand the situation, of course the heart can feel more easeful. So, you know, cultivation, you know, turning the mind, directing the mind towards joy or balance of mind. So bringing it, or, you know, maybe generosity, you know, it really varies. So all of the tools to cultivating the wholesome qualities, and humor can be a wholesome quality. So, time to stop. Sorry, I went over a little bit. Thank you.